ice on lake and river. Fell the snow o'er all the landscape. Fell the covering snow and drifted through the forest, round the village. Hardly from his buried wigwam could the hunter force a passage. Vainly walked he through the forest, saw no track of deer or rabbit, fell and could not rise from weakness.
Well, what have we here? You got a clue?
Wasting of the famine, oh, the blasting of the fever, oh, the wailing of the children, oh, the anguish of the women. All the earth was sick and famished. Hungry was the air around them, hungry was the sky above them, and the hungry stars in heaven, like the eyes of wolves, glared at them.
I thought I knew where we were. Somebody started in the middle of the largo of the Dvorak New World Symphony, the slow movement. And then all of a sudden, this magnificent voice started intoning very softly, something that sounded vaguely like Hiawatha, but it's been too long since I read it. So what have we here, Dvorak and Hiawatha? Well, gather in, my friends. I'm going to tell you a mystery. We're going to find out what this is, this strange and beautiful combination of music of Dvorak with, I think, the words of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Hi, this is Bill McLaughlin, and I've got a couple great partners in the studio with me. You're listening to Post Classical, which is pretty much the brainstorm of the great author, pianist, scholar, Joseph Horowitz, who's sitting across from me, and the wonderful conductor, Angel Gil Ordóñez. You guys collaborated on a marvelous recording, which brings together some of the most beautiful music of Antonín Dvořák, music from the time he was living in America, early 1890s, 92 to 95, I think. He had read Hiawatha in Czech translation before he came here, didn't he, Joe?
Indeed. We were just sampling the Hiawatha melodrama, which is a co-creation of Angel and myself and the music historian Michael Beckerman. We know that Dvořák was inspired by Longfellow's Song of Hiawatha in composing the New World Symphony. He said so. He also very specifically told us that the opening of the scherzo was inspired by the dance of Paupakiwis at Hiawatha's wedding. All this information was laying dormant for decades and decades and decades until Michael Beckerman came along in the 1990s and began to look closely at the alignment between Dvorak's symphony and Longfellow's verses, and what he discovered is amazing. So amazing that this melodrama was born. In music, the term melodrama means combining the spoken word and music. So this is 35 minutes of the spoken word and music. Almost all the music, but not all of it, is from the New World Symphony. There's also excerpts from the violin sonatina of Dvorak and the American Suite of Dvorak.
So this is an imagining, in a way, of an opera which Dvorak longed to create but did not create. He spent these 3 years here in America, went back to Prague at least once or twice, went to Spillville, Iowa in the summer of 1893 and spent that whole summer in the heartland of America, where incidentally, he ran into an Indian troupe of dancers. He heard dancers in Spillville.
The Kickapoo Medicine Show.
And his daughter started to find herself somewhat charmed by one of the young braves.
So we understand.
Which really made Dvorak nervous, so he took the whole family to Chicago for the weekend.
This is a story that's been many times told.
Yeah. Let's do the story, quite an interesting story about how Dvorak came to America. I lay the credit for this wonderful development at the feet of an American heroine named Jeanette Thurber. Jeanette Thurber was married to a man who adored her, who had made a lot of money in the grocery business. He ran the old A&P grocery stores. Atlantic and Pacific, right? This is the 1880s. And she already wasted one of his fortunes trying to make an opera company in English. And she said, that didn't work because we don't have an American school of music. We need to get composers here. And she looked at, first of all, well, Tchaikovsky was the big deal. He was coming at that time to dedicate Carnegie Hall. still named the Music Hall. That was 1891. She looked at Sibelius, who was a hot young thing, and she finally settled on the best choice of all, Antonín Dvořák, composer and teacher from Prague.
She learned that Sibelius was a heavy drinker, which gave the job to Dvořák. She offered him so much money, he couldn't say no. He didn't know what he was getting into, but when he found out, he liked it, because Dvořák was a cultural nationalist. He was a devotee of folk song. He thought music was born in the soil, and instantly he wanted to know, okay, where's your folk music? He principally found it among Native Americans and African Americans. He'd already read the Song of Hiawatha, and he took up the challenge of writing music that would inspire American composers to acquire an American style. All of this precedes the premiere of what is still the most performed and beloved symphony ever composed on American soil, the New World Symphony. And we thought we knew this piece, but it turns out that we didn't.
Well, let's see, we do know the piece. We know it very beautifully, and we've heard it over and again and love it. But there's more to it than what we knew. I would say that.
It's amazing how much we now know about what was in Dvorak's head. And what was mainly in his head was the Song of Hiawatha. So many, many, many things in this symphony correlate with the Song of Hiawatha. As Beckerman has shown, the entire scherzo is essentially a tone poem setting the chapter Hiawatha's Wedding Feast, which is the Dance of Papukiwis, the Song of Chibiabos, and the Tale of Iyagu. They're all in there. And why don't we go back to the melodrama and listen to the opening of the scherzo with the words, and you will hear how the whirling, spinning dance of Papukiwis is translated into music by Dvorak. So you'll hear a triangle in this music because the Indians had bells on their moccasins when they danced.
All right, now, what we're listening to is music of Dvorak. I won't say truncated, I won't say pastiche, but it is. You've kind of taken parts of Dvorak, put them with parts of Longfellow, is that correct?
Yeah, all we'll hear now, we'll hear the whole piece later, is Kevin Days telling us about the Dance of Papukiwis, and then how Dvorak translates that into music.
Okay, and for those of you at home with a score, this is the third movement, the scherzo.
It's the opening of the scherzo.
You shall hear how Papukiwis danced at Hiawatha's wedding. First he danced a solemn measure, treading softly like a panther. Then more swiftly and still swifter, whirling, spinning round in circles, leaping o'er the guests assemble, heading round and round the wigwam, till the leaves went whirling with him like great snow drifts o'er the landscape.
So there's the scherzo of Dvorak's New World Symphony with the words of Hiawatha applied over it. Now I have to ask our conductor, Angel, you've conducted this symphony many times, I'm sure, without the poetry. How does it feel when you add the narrator in? For one thing, did you accompany the narrator? How did you guys actually record it? Did you have the narrator in the same room with your orchestra?
Well, what we always do, as you know, is we perform live before recording. So we already had done this with Kevin one or 2 days before, live. So I was giving him cues and he knew exactly. And then for the recording, we did the music first and then we had Kevin doing the narration after that.
Kevin Days is a marvelous singer. He's got a huge voice, but he has a voice with so many colors and so much dramatic sense, and he's a wonderful storyteller. He's a great performer. He's done probably more Porgies in the opera Porgy and Bess than anyone alive right now. He commands that role presently. And he knows, as well as any narrator you've ever worked with, how to fit into an orchestra. But in this case, you're fitting him into stuff that was already recorded. That's interesting. It makes it more clear, though, doesn't it? It gives you complete clarity of the voice.
Absolutely. As you mentioned before, the narration brings a complete new dimension to the listening of the piece. And I'm totally convinced that it really enhances it. And actually, I took the very slow tempi.
Yes.
Because I thought that it was very important, since we had a new element that was interacting with the music, to have even more time to perceive the whole thing.
Right. I see. So if you're in a concert hall where you have none of this text and story to keep your imagination busy, then you probably do go a little faster because the music has to tell it all. Here, it's a very complicated and very interesting mix that you've attempted here. It's very brave, Joe. This is really courageous of you to try this.
We like to be reckless. I would like to talk about the ending of the symphony because it has a dirge. So you guys know this symphony. Don't you agree with me that if you conduct this symphony, you need to be able to account for a funeral taking place at the end of the finale? Isn't that an odd move by the composer? Why is there
a
dirge at the end of the New World Symphony?
I don't remember the dirge. I remember it as fast. And what it does is makes it into minuendo on the last chord, which is very unusual.
It's the horns with the timpani taps.
Uh-huh.
That's, I would say, self-evidently a dirge.
Uh-huh. I never thought of it that way.
What did you think of it as?
I thought it was the energy winding down the way it does in sometimes a Beethoven symphony where it's been wum pum 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 and then tum pum pum. I thought it was just purely musical terms.
Well, why don't we listen and you tell us what you think.
Okay.
To the ending of the melodrama where this passage is explicitly interpreted as a dirge.
Thus departed Hiawatha in the purple mists of evening to the region of the home wind, to the land of the hereafter.
Well, I did hear marvelously solemn music, maybe even tragic music, and then I heard a jump to a different movement. That's not the ending of the Dvorak Symphony. It does end fast.
Okay,
it's what
so
I remembered. You skipped to the second movement, Joe.
Let's talk about one thing at a time.
Well, let's talk about that.
We'll in a moment, but with those timpani taps, how could this not be a dirge?
Well, I think it's getting close to the end of a symphony. A frequent composer goes back and recalls a tune, dee da 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 da, which is almost as a march. You do use it as a march, like a march of anger when Hiawatha is pursuing the bad guy.
But the timpani taps.
I hear it, Joe. I hear it. I hear it in the Dvorak Night Symphony. I hear that as a natural thing where you had all of this energy and he calms it down, and it is melancholy. Who knows what reason? I find it particularly Czech, though, to tell you the truth.
I would even go so far as to make the following statement.
Yeah.
Dvorak in New York, his closest friend was Anton Seidl. Seidl was a protege of Wagner. It is a fact that Dvorak's style becomes more Wagnerian in New York, and he retains that influence when he goes back to Prague and composes three operas.
Right.
And you can almost hear at the end of the scherzo, Die Walküre.
Hmm.
I believe this passage you just heard is inspired by the funeral music from Goethe Dämmerung, which has exactly the same timpani taps as the timpani taps we just heard.
But it's interesting because where you went from almost the end of the finale, as Dvorak wrote it, then you go to the opening chords, which are all the closing chords of the slow movement. It happens in a nice instance that he's in E minor. You can make it to E major, which is what you need for that second movement, before you settle down into D flat. A little bit of a harmonic sleight of hand there.
I'm very proud of that. Thank you for pointing it out. Yes, the magic of the ending of the slow movement is famous. I mean, where else do you find pianissimo chords for double basses ending a movement?
Right.
It's a famous passage.
Mm.
So I've appropriated it and stuck it onto the end of my funeral march to end the melodrama.
Yeah, I get it, because you're creating a brand new piece in a way.
Sort of.
Yeah. Of course, you know, like we hear something that you know and love so much, It's like somebody messing with your uncle's portrait. You don't like it very much the first time you said it, whatever. you put a mustache on my uncle. My uncle never had a mustache.
Not only do we have a dirge, what do you make of the fact that the final chord of this symphony diminishes to silence? Isn't that kind of an odd touch as well?
It's very unusual. And I think Dvorak had a very, very hard time making finales, to tell you the truth. Fifth symphony, sixth symphony, seventh symphony, eighth symphony, they're hard for him to make. He doesn't know how to do it. Eighth symphony gives you wonderful sets of variations. It goes fast, it goes slow. Yeah. He doesn't know what to do with himself. And usually has a ragtag circus band ending. I think this was a version that's the opposite of a circus band ending. And when usually I make it loud, this time I'll make it diminish.
This is a very, very odd ending.
It is not any.
It has a dirge and it has a final chord. It actually has a dirge and then a kind of apotheosis and then a final chord diminishing to silence. And I maintain that if you read the ending of the Song of Hiawatha, you are reading the music that was in Dvorak's ear when he wrote the strange ending to that symphony. Angel, what do you think?
Well, I agree that you are absolutely right. It is very Wagnerian. I mean, the brass is Wagnerian. Even those phenomenal, beautiful initial chords of the second movement that are actually used here in the end. So I never thought of that, actually, the Wagnerian component of this. And now that you mention it, it makes really total
And it's
sense.
Wagnerian, too, to use leitmotifs.
For
this
sure.
is a quasi-programmatic symphony.
Yeah.
And his last symphony, as Beckerman has pointed out, he's transitioning from symphony to opera in this work.
And tone poems.
Oh, thank you.
I mean,
especially
when he writes the tone poems when he goes back to
which
Prague.
Which are incredibly literal.
Yep. I love them.
Yep.
And they are, as a body of work, superior to the symphonies, and we never hear them.
I used to conduct them.
Good
I'm sure
for
you have too.
The one that I like best is the Mahlerian one, the Wood Dove, which Mahler, in fact, did conduct.
Okay, in addition to mostly being the largo of the New World Symphony, the slow movement, a couple of passages so far from what we've heard from the finale, you also use a wonderful sonatina, which has a story. Dvorak was on a tour. I told you he took his family away from Spillville, Iowa to take them to Chicago. He was playing at the World's Fair. A big, big deal. He may have run into a lot of other people. He ran into John Philip Sousa, for one thing, maybe even Scott Joplin. And then he made a tour of other towns with big Czech populations. He went to Omaha, he came to St. Paul. And the priest who had organized the festival for him in St. Paul said, you know, just across the river, there's beautiful falls, which we call the Minnehaha Falls. As soon as Dvorak could, he got a whole procession and then went over to see it. And years later, I actually got on a bike and rode across the bridge from St. Paul to Minnehaha Falls. My engineer had fixed up a kind of baffle so I could be talking. I said, come with me. We're going to go across the Mississippi River right up to the Minnehaha Falls. And here's Dvorak leaning in, and he got the idea for this violin tune. People said they had to hold onto his coat to keep him from falling into the falls. I mean, it's not Niagara Falls, but it's a couple hundred feet tall.
Sure.
Beckerman has actually traced the tune, which is the waterfall tune and the larghetto of the violin sonatina to this very moment that you're describing,
right,
and the usual inscription on his shirt cuff. That's the way he would notate music.
You know why we know that? His laundress complained because he used India ink. Can you imagine his big double cuffs? And he got an idea. He just grabbed a pen and scribbled on it with India ink. She had to get that stuff out eventually.
So in order to tell the story of Hiawatha, you have to talk about the wooing of Minnehaha. And here I used the larghetto, which is, in effect, a cameo, a portrait of Minnehaha. This entire piece, the larghetto from the violin sonatina, which Kreisler, when he played it, called Indian Lament,
right,
can be read as a portrait of Minnehaha. And since that's a piece for violin and piano, Angel had to orchestrate it. Why don't we talk about that after we listen to a little bit of this music, which Angel orchestrated for the melodrama?
Let's listen. This is the post-classical ensemble under our resident conductor here, the great maestro, Angel Gil Ordóñez.
She bans him, she obeys him. Though she draws him, yet she follows. Thus the youthful Hiawatha said within himself and pondered. Much perplexed by various feelings. listless, longing, hoping, feeling, dreaming still of Minnehaha, of the lovely laughing water.
So that's just a taste of this music describing Minnehaha, utilizing music of Dvorak, particularly from the violin sonatina, which he wrote for his kids, his daughter and his son. His daughter was a violinist. And Ahau, that's a beautiful orchestration. That's a piece originally for piano, rather slim piano part. I used to be able to play that myself. That's how I know.
Me too.
It's so complicated.
Me too, actually. It was the only piece for violin that played by Dvorak.
But it's very beautiful. And Joe, you bring out the point that Fritz Kreisler, when he played this as an encore piece, used to call it Indian Lament.
Right.
I have a question. If you were to come across this manuscript and you didn't know who'd written it, and it looked like some 19th century European writer, but it was titled Ton Poem on an Ancient Hebraic Theme, would you buy it?
Well, I'm very biased. What I buy is the notion that this is a portrait of Minnehaha composed by Dvorak in Iowa. I'm so locked into that, it's hard for me to hear it any other way. Well, if you were asked me to defend the thesis that Dvorak had an Indianist trope, I would say one of the features is repeated notes, which you do hear in that theme. But the clearest examples that we'll be dealing with here are the G minor theme from the first movement of the New World Symphony and the C sharp minor theme from the Largo and the C sharp minor theme from the American Suite. And probably we'll get to those. He typically orchestrates his Indian themes for a combination of flute and oboe. That sound for him obviously evoked what he heard when he heard Indians singing. I agree that this is not as pure an example of his Indian mode as examples we can cite from the American Suite and the New World Symphony.
So that theme that we hear that sticks in our minds, that's not the theme you just told me before we went on the air that Dvorak got as he listened to the waterfall there in Minnehaha Park.
No, the waterfall has its own theme, and you cannot mistake it for anything but water music. Why don't we listen to that, as orchestrated by Angel?
And he named her from the river, from the waterfall, he named her Minnehaha, Laughing Water.
It's charming. I love the harp. Where'd you come up with that? In your sock drawer, right?
So, you know, the fascinating part to me about the project is that not only I was the conductor of the whole music, is that Joe told me, well, you have to orchestrate what I have written. So Joe gave me all the melodic lines. So my participation as a arranger was the first part of the melodrama and the ending of the melodrama. So in this first part, of course, what I have tried is to respect as much as possible and try to imitate as much as possible the Dvorak style of orchestrating. In the case of the waterfall, I actually use only woodwinds. And then you told me, no, you have to use a harp. So I said, well, you know, it makes sense to have a harp. And actually, the harp brings not only this more poignant character, but it brings also a very funny aspect to it, which I think goes very well with the character that
I made him do it twice, and he was especially proud of the orchestration.
Yeah, I was very happy with what I did.
This particular theme.
You know, with all the woodwinds, because it's very complicated. So, you know, with only woodwinds, I use the clarinet. Okay, so good. Let's have the harp. And then it works very well with two flutes doing the repeats. And then the pizzicati too. And then I use the trombones at the end, which also brings a very strange, but I think beautiful character.
With the harp, too, it has a character of, it almost has like a childlike innocence to it,
which
I love.
That's
well, you've got the piano here at the very top of the register playing rolled chords.
Yeah, and actually, and Dvorak marks out arpeggiando, like a harp.
Exactly. It made total sense.
But surely we can agree this is water music.
It's beautiful.
Okay.
I'm usually the one, when I'm with orchestras, I'm painting the pictures. Today, I'm the one that's being a big old grump and say, it's G major. So what are we going to hear now, Joe?
We'll do one more excerpt before we go to the full melodrama. The other piece mm-hmm. that I've culled mm-hmm. is the American Suite, which mm-hmm. we'll hear the entirety of later on. Mm-hmm. My favorite passage in the American Suite is the C-sharp minor Indian tune in the third movement. That's the same key as a comparable passage we've already heard from the Largo. And I use this like a leitmotif and bring it back at the end of the melodrama. So let's listen to this beautiful passage from the American Suite. So that's Dvorak's orchestration. But when I bring this back at the end of the melodrama, this is Angel's orchestration of my allusion to that theme.
By the shore of Gitche Gumee, Hiawatha stood and waited. Gone was every trace of sorrow.
Lovely. That's piano music originally?
The American Suite exists in two versions.
Uh-huh.
As a piano piece and as an orchestral piece. So here I am composing, using this as a leitmotif and bringing it back with my partner, Angel.
So what happened here is that, as you heard before, in the American Suite, tarariri, tarariri, it's a 3-4. And then, for whatever reason, I started writing it in a 4-4. And then it became, in my opinion, even more dramatic.
Mm.
Because now this is what we had. It's almost Malerian. Tarariri, 3-4.
Tarariri, yeah.
And I thought it went very well. So it was a misunderstanding. So I knew that he wanted to refer to that, but somehow I added one more beat, and in my opinion, it becomes even more dramatic than the other
yes,
part.
It's definitely better, in my opinion.
Be fun to get together with Dvorak. Can you imagine him smoking one of those big, stinky old stogies he was so fond of? In this little recording room, we'd have to take a break every 20 minutes just to put up with it. We'd have to have fans and everything. But I think of all the composers, of all the great composers, I'd rather hang out with him for one night than almost anyone.
You'd have to drink a lot.
Well, beer, mostly.
No, but yeah, but his capacity, according to Huneker, was unprecedented. Huneker had never seen anybody who could hold his liquor the way Dvorak could.
Huh. It's interesting because I know when he was in Spillville in Iowa,
he'd get buckets of beer.
because we get it from the brewery, and he would get a kid to bring a great big bucket of beer every afternoon. He'd start that morning by playing mass at the church, you know, and he'd write and he'd talk. But around, you know, like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the old Czech guys would start be coming over and he'd have a bucket of beer for them, and they'd finish that off and probably send the kid back to get another.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He was a big drinker.
Well, you know what? He turned it into beautiful music, if that's the way. I remember thinking the slow movement of the string quartet, which he wrote while he was in Spillville, that D minor, is some of the loneliest, saddest music. And I remember his walking around that graveyard there in Spillville, and he's looking at the gravestones of these people. They're Czech people. Funny, the name Spillville comes from German. It was originally a man named Spielmann.
Uh-huh.
And they got it wrong when he made it. The post office became Spillville. But these were Czechs who'd come after 1848. And this is now in the 1890s. So these old guys had died, old men and old women had died 4,000 or 5,000 miles from home. And when you stand in that churchyard with the wind coming off from the prairie in back of you, rustling the leaves, I think that's where the slow mo of the American quartet comes from. And I think it's the loneliest, saddest music I know.
He said it was sad to despair. The loneliness of the prairie.
Right.
He'd never seen such vast, uninhabited terrain.
It's just funny because he grew up in farm country in Bohemia.
People. There were people.
People for thousands of years weren't as... Well, there were people here. They were just a little further spread around and they didn't tend to...
He said you only see cows.
Well, I think he must have been enchanted with cows. I know he's enchanted with birds and he worked birds into his music often. Yeah, I think Dvořák would have been fun to hang out with. Well, I think it's time to unwrap this pudding, see what we've got here. This is a beautiful, courageous composition, imagining on the part of Joseph Horowitz and Michael Beckerman, bringing together the words of Longfellow from Hiawatha with the opera that Dvořák dreamed of but never quite got around to writing. So the music is all from Dvořák, almost all without exception, and the words are all from Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. So let's hear this piece in its entirety. And Angel, will you tell us what we're going to hear?
So we have a prologue. We have Hiawatha's wooing, Hiawatha's wedding feast, the death of Minnehaha, the hunting of Papakiwis, and the epilogue, which is the Hiawatha's departure.
And just for a little help, anyone doesn't have a copy of Longfellow around, Papakiwi is a really, really bad guy. And we meet him right after the death of the beautiful maiden Minnehaha. I'll give you a sort of idea of the shape of this melodrama. In this performance, we're hearing Post-Classical Ensemble under its director, Angel Gil Ordóñez. This is a collaboration of Joseph Horowitz, Michael Beckerman, and Antonín Dvořák. Here we go, Hiawatha, the melodrama.
Should you ask me, whence these stories? With the curling smoke of wigwams, with the rushing of great rivers and their wild reverberations, as a thunder in the mountains, I should answer, I should tell you. From the forests and the prairies, from the great lakes of the Northland, from the land of the Ojibways, from the land of the Dakotas, I repeat them as I heard them from the lips of Nawadaha, the musician, the sweet singer. There he sang of Hiawatha, sang the song of Hiawatha. How he lived and toiled and suffered that he might advance his people. Ye who love the haunts of nature, love the sunshine of the meadow and the thunder in the mountains whose innumerable echoes flap like eagles in their aeries, listen to these wild traditions, to this Song of Hiawatha. As unto the bow the cord is, so unto the man is woman. Though she bans him, she obeys him. Though she draws him, yet she follows. Thus the youthful Hiawatha said within himself and pondered. Much perplexed by various feelings. Listless, longing, hoping, feeling, dreaming still of Minnehaha, of the lovely laughing water. There the ancient arrow maker made his arrowheads of sandstone. With him dwelt his dark-eyed daughter, wayward as a Minnehaha, with her moods of shade and sunshine. Eyes that smiled and frowned alternate, tresses flowing like the water, and as musical a laughter. And he named her from the river, from the waterfall, he named her Minnehaha, Laughing Water. Was it then for heads of arrows that my Hiawatha halted in the land of the Dakotas? Was it not to see the maiden, see the face of laughing water peeping from behind the curtain, hear the rustling of her garments from behind the waving curtain? As one sees the Minnehaha gleaming, glancing through the branches, as one hears the laughing water from behind its screen of branches. Thus departed Hiawatha to the land of handsome women. Through uninterrupted silence with his moccasins of magic. And he journeyed without resting till he heard the Minnehaha. Straight, the ancient arrow maker looked up gravely from his labor, bade him enter at the doorway, saying as he rose to meet him, Hiawatha, you are welcome. And the lovely laughing water seemed more lovely as she stood there. Neither willing nor reluctant, as she went to Hiawatha, softly took the seat beside him, while she said, and blushed to say it, I will follow you, my husband. Pleasant was the journey homeward, through interminable forests, over meadow, over mountain, over river, hill, and hollow. Short it seemed to Hiawatha, though they journeyed very slowly. Though his pace was checked and slackened to the steps of laughing water. From the sky benignant, looked upon them through the branches, saying, Oh, my children, love is sunshine. Life is checkered, shade and sunshine. Rule by love, O Hiawatha. Thus it was they journeyed homeward. Thus it was that Hiawatha brought the sunshine of his people, Minnehaha, laughing water, handsomest of all the women in the land of the Dakotas. In the land of handsome women. You shall hear how Paupu Kiwis danced at Hiawatha's wedding. First he danced a solemn measure, treading softly like a panther. Then more swiftly and still swifter, whirling, spinning round in circles, leaping o'er the guests assemble, heading round and round the wigwam, till the leaves went whirling with him like great snow drifts o'er the landscape.
Thank you.
gentle Chibiabos sang in accents sweet and tender. On a way, awake, beloved. Thou the wild flower of the forest, thou the wild bird of the prairie. Thou with eyes so soft and fawn-like, if you only look'st at me, I am happy. I am happy as the lilies of the prairie when they feel the dew upon them. On a way, awake, beloved. And among the guests assembled at my Hiawatha's wedding sat the marvelous storyteller. And they said, "Oh, good Iagoo, tell us now a tale of wonder." And Iagoo answered straightway, "You shall hear the strange adventures of Osio, the magician. Once in days no more remembered in the Northland lived a hunter, with 10 young and comely daughters. All these women married warriors. Only Oweenee, the youngest, laughed and flouted all her lovers, and then married old Osio. Old Osio, poor and ugly. But Osio was transfigured, was restored to youth and beauty, but alas for good Osio, and for Oweenee the faithful, changed into a weak old woman. Then a voice was heard, a whisper coming from the starry distance. Oh, Osio, broken are the spells that bound you. Then the lodge began to tremble, and they felt it rising, rising slowly through the air ascending, from the darkness of the treetop forth into the dewy starlight. And behold, the wooden dishes all were changed to shells of scarlet. And behold, the earthen kettles all were changed to bowls of silver. All the sisters and their husbands changed to birds of various plumage. Some were jays, some were magpies, others thrushes, others blackbirds. And they hopped and sang and twittered, pecked and fluttered all their feathers, and their tails like fans unfolded. Then returned the youth and beauty of Oweenee the youngest, and her staff became a feather, yes, a shining silver feather. Such was Hiawatha's wedding, such the dance of Paupukiwis, such the story of Iagoo, such the songs of Chibiabos. Thus the wedding banquet ended, and the wedding guests departed. ice on lake and river. Fell the snow o'er all the landscape. Fell the covering snow and drifted through the forest, round the village. Hardly from his buried wigwam could the hunter force a passage. Vainly walked he through the forest, saw no track of deer or rabbit, fell and could not rise from weakness. Wasting of the famine, oh the blasting of the fever, oh the wailing of the children, oh the anguish of the women. All the earth was sick and famished. Hungry was the air around them, hungry was the sky above them, and the hungry stars in heaven, like the eyes of wolves, glared at them. Far away, amid the forest, rose the desolate Hiawatha. Heard that sudden cry of anguish, heard the voice of Minnehaha. Hiawatha! Hiawatha! Rushed into the wigwam, saw his lovely Minnehaha lying dead and cold before him. With both hands his face he covered, speechless, motionless, unconscious of the daylight or the dark. You shall hear how Paupu Kiwis, he, the handsome Yenadize, vexed the village with disturbance. You shall hear of all his mischief and his flight from Hiawatha and his wondrous transmigrations at the end of his adventures. Now from his lodge went Paupu Kiwis, climbed upon the rocky headlands, perched himself upon their summit. Round him hovered, fluttered, rustled Hiawatha's mountain chickens, and he killed them as he lay there, slaughtered them by tens and twenties, threw their bodies down the headland. Perched upon a crag about them, at length shouted Kayoshk the seagull, "It is Paupu Kiwis! He is slaying us by hundreds. Send a message to our brother. Tidings send to Hiawatha." Full of wrath was Hiawatha when he came into the village, found the people in confusion, heard of all the misdemeanors, all the malice and the mischief of the cunning Paupu Kiwis. His breath came through his nostrils. Through his teeth he buzzed and muttered words of anger. and resentment. I will slay this foul Pulkiwis, slay this mischief maker. Not so rude and rough the way that my wrath shall not attain him. I will slay this foul Pulkiwis, slay this mischief maker. Not so long and wide the world that my vengeance shall not reach him. Then in swift pursuit departed Hiawatha and the hunters. And aloud cried Hiawatha from the summit of the mountain. Not so long and wide the world, not so rude and rough, but my wrath shall overtake you, and my vengeance shall attain you. Over rock and over river, through bush and brake and forest, ran the cunning Pau Pulkiwis. Like an antelope he bounded, till he came unto a streamlet in the middle of the forest, to a streamlet still and tranquil that it overflowed its margins. Over rock and over river, through bush and brake and forest, ran the cunning Pau Pulkiwis, to a dam made by the beavers, to a pond of quiet water. On the dam stood Pau Pulkiwis, o'er his ankles flowed the streamlet, flowed the bright and silvery water. And he spake unto the beaver, with a smile he spake in this wise. Cool and pleasant is the water. Then he heard a cry from above him, heard a shouting and a tramping. Through the roof looked Hiawatha, vain your manifold disguises. With his club he beat and bruised him, beat to death poor Pau Pulkiwis. But the ghost, the Jebby in him, still lived on as Pau Pulkiwis, and it fluttered, strove, and struggled, till it took the form and features of the cunning Pau Pulkiwis, vanishing into the forest. Next, the people of the village saw the wings of Pau Pulkiwis flapping far up in the ether, followed fast by Hiawatha. Then the cunning Pau Pulkiwis, once again in human figure, came unto the headlands. There without stood Hiawatha, smote great caverns in the sandstone, cried aloud in tones of thunder, "Open! I am Hiawatha!" But the old man of the mountain opened not. "Open! I am Hiawatha!" Then he raised his hands to heaven, called imploring on the tempest, called Wewasimo the lightning, and the thunder, Animiki, and they came with night and darkness, sweeping down the big sea water from the distant thunder mountains, and the trembling Pau Pulkiwis heard the footsteps of the thunder, saw the red eyes of the lightning, was afraid, and crouched, and trembled.
Then Wayrasimha the lightning smote the doorways of the cavern. With his war club smote the doorways, smote the jutting crags of sandstone. And the thunder Animiki shouted down into the caverns. Where is Kal Vulkiris? And the crags fell.
And beneath them, dead among the rocky ruins, lay the cunning Paupukiwis, lay the handsome Yenadize, slain in his own human figure. By the shore of Gitche Gumee, Hiawatha stood and waited. Gone was every trace of sorrow. Of one who in a vision sees what is to be, but is not. On the shore stood Hiawatha, launched his birch canoe for sailing, sailed into the fiery sunset, sailed into the dusk of evening. Thus departed Hiawatha in the purple mists of evening to the regions of the home wind, to the land of the here.
Before I say another word, I want to compliment you on how those four bass players play absolutely beautifully in tune. That last D flat major chord, that's so difficult to play, and they play it spectacularly well. Bravo, sir.
It is, thank you.
Bravo, maestro.
Well, bravo the musicians, absolutely.
Yeah. Post-classical ensemble under Angel Gil Ordóñez, collaboration of Joseph Horwitz and Michael Beckerman, who very courageously tried to put together Hiawatha of Longfellow with music of Dvorak. Dvorak left a lot of evidence that he was working on an opera or wanted to work on an opera of Hiawatha. And the two of you had the courage to put this together. You actually have to make this like a composition, don't you? You have to figure out which sections of the text go with which parts of the music. You're actually putting these things together like a jigsaw puzzle almost.
It came to me pretty quickly, actually. So what do you think?
I'm still getting used to it. When I first heard it, I thought, can't work. I mean, because I know the Dvorak so well, and it's been too long since I read Hiawatha, which is interesting, because that came out around 1855. That's around the time that Whitman made his first volume of Leaves of Grass, and Longfellow, for me, was from another age. So I love Whitman and that stuff going forward the other way, and when I think of American poetry, that's what I thought of. So it sounded kind of wonderful, but very old-fashioned to me. In a way, the language is much more old-fashioned than Dvorak sounds to me. This is a peculiar fact. A lot of times, music written from the 19th century still sounds pretty fresh to me, and it's the rare poet. Usually it's a great lyric poet rather than a lengthier sort of poet that can survive the passage of time the way music can.
Yeah, I have the same impression.
Anyway, I think it's a very, very brave piece, and I think we should hear it again a lot, and you can make up your mind. I also can think that this is a wonderful piece for kids. You can actually tell them the story of Hiawatha. They can hear it out loud. It's told for them brilliantly. I can imagine like teenagers falling in love with this album in a way that would change their lives.
Thank you.
Before we leave this segment, I want to sing the praises of the miraculous, wonderful Kevin Dace, who was your narrator there. He's a terrific singer, as obviously he's got a dramatic sense too.
Absolutely.
It's been a ball to work with him. Bravo, Kevin. You've been listening to Post Classical with Joseph Horowitz, Angel Gil Ordóñez, and me, Bill McLaughlin. This is an exclusive production of the award-winning Classical Network and WWFM.org.